for the wealthy daddy. War, corruption, treason, and an open season on human rights. Tears at the fabric of our nation, and the tragic realization is that future generations will pay the big price. Wake up and shake it up, America. From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea. Our government is a fine for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully. This land is your land.
This land is my land.
If we come together and work together, we can pull the weeds that threaten to destroy our land. I hope and pray you understand. We cannot reap a good harvest with a bunch of bad seeds. Wake up and shake it up, America. From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea. Our government is a fight for we the people who can ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully.
Abraham Lincoln proclaimed, "We are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, not of the corporations, by the corporations, and for the corporations." He also observed, "You can fool all of the people some of the time, and some of the people all of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time."
Wake up, shake it up, America.
Our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully. Wake up and shake it up, America. North to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea. Our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully. Wake up and shake it up, America.
Welcome to another episode of Taking Back America, the official show of Take Back America for the people. We are an educational nonprofit whose mission is to tell the American people about the costs of allowing corporate control of their government. And we also reach out around the world, of course, on the internet. We stream live every week. And so this is really a message for everybody in the world, because we're going to be talking about a global problem, and that is global climate change. My guest today is Margaret Klein Salomon. She is the founder of the Climate Mobilization. She is a clinical psychologist who recently completed her PhD, but put her career aside to work on this full time, which is really I think quite impressive. She's also the director of the Climate Mobilization, and they have some interesting ideas about how to organize a worldwide movement to demand that our governments do something to deal with the threat of global climate change. Margaret, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, boy, like I said, I was pretty impressed when I looked at your website. Obviously, you're very committed to this. Why was it so critical to you that you would give up a career you just spent all this time preparing yourself for in order to work on this full time?
Well, my journey went from some level of denial to becoming more and more alarmed about climate change, to realizing at having a very critical personal realization brought on by a friend posing a challenge to me, that I could do something about climate change, that I don't have to be a passive victim of a collapsing climate and civilization, that the more yeah, the more I learned about what the coming decades will hold, the more the life I had planned, in which I would be a psychotherapist, and I like to write, so I thought I'll be a psychotherapist and I'll write books or a blog or both. And I started to get involved in climate change. I thought I'll make a blog about climate change. You know, I'll talk about it. But until feeling like an agent who could actually make a difference in what's happening, I didn't feel 100% committed. But that shift in perspective, I don't know, it takes over. Once you understand how bad the situation is and then feel like you can make a real contribution to avoiding the catastrophe that we're heading towards, I think it's there's no going back. It's I couldn't do anything else.
Well, I can certainly relate to that feeling. I guess I had an experience like that. And by the way, Margaret, I didn't tell you before we started the show, I'm a psychotherapist also, and I put my work aside pretty much for the same reason. I guess I saw some of the things you did, and maybe before that I also did not feel empowered. But one of the things that I've come to learn is that we all have power. But really, in order to accomplish these things, we need to exercise our collective power. And that's what you're doing with the climate mobilization, right?
That's the hope.
Okay, well, that's also the inspiration we have to give people, because I think you're absolutely right. The reason people don't get active is because they don't feel that their individual actions make a difference. Let's hope that you and me and all the other people that have realized that we cannot afford to sit by if we care about our children, we have to get active now. So I wanted to talk, before we get into the details of what you're doing with the climate mobilization and the kind of things you're writing about in your blog, The Climate Psychologist, I want to just tell people they can read that blog at theclimatemobilization.org. Anyway, before we get into
theclimatemobilization.org is the climate mobilization site, and theclimatepsychologist.com is my climate psychology blog.
Right, but they're linked, I believe. There's certainly some of the same blogs are on both. Is that right?
Absolutely. There's okay. There's an increasing amount of overlap.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so anyway, I wanted to start by, you mentioned denial. You know, even you and I were in denial about a lot of aspects about climate change, even though I suspect that, like me, you didn't really doubt the scientists, since we're both trained scientists. As a psychologist, have you given much thought to this denial and how to break through it? Well, as a psychotherapist, how do you break through people's denial? Starting with this first example of people who accept the idea of climate change, but don't think they can do anything about it, so they deny its seriousness. Well, how do you approach that?
So you are articulating really the central question that I approached in the entire field of climate change and climate change activism from that question. Which is how the Pledge to Mobilize strategy became developed. The question is, you know, scientists are telling us, they've been telling us for a long time, but they're telling us with ever more clarity and insistence that we are in terrible danger. And the amount, the gap between what is happening and what scientists tell us is happening and the impact that it has on most people's day-to-day lives is, I mean, there's no better word for it than denial. I mean, it's or I mean, you could say maybe delusion or dissociation. I think is a really important concept for this. But so realizing that if we did get out of denial as a group and realize that climate change is a horrifying prospect that threatens all of us, all of civilization, all of our future, that would be such a transformative change, right? That would be virtually everything that is needed to instigate a transformation, right? All you need to do to succeed politically on climate change is activate the truth within people rather than denial. So I think it's and I think until you get past denial and get to the truth, I don't think really there's any chance of success. In World War II, which is central to the idea of climate mobilization, it's a World War II scale climate mobilization. We use what the United States did during World War II as the model of what we need to do again, because it was such an incredible example of a democratic economic and social mobilization that accomplished, you know, such historically incredible achievements. So, but it didn't just happen. It took Pearl Harbor, actually, to get the United States, the American people, the vast majority, out of the denial that they called isolationism. The idea that, that war over there, it's in Europe, it doesn't have to do with us, we don't want to get involved, that Americans did not want to believe, and I mean, I can understand their desire not to believe that another world war was coming. So they rejected what was going on. They were isolationists until one day, because of the surprise attack, the devastating surprise attacks on Pearl Harbor, it was like the denial lifted. It was just gone overnight. Isolationism evaporated, and there was a almost unanimous declaration of war. So that, and then we mobilized. There had been some groundwork laid, but it takes that level of collective understanding that we are in an emergency now, and we are going to make, everybody is going to make changes to their life in order to actively contribute to solving this emergency.
So what you're saying is, now you're talking primarily about, at this point anyway, about soliciting individual efforts so that people will be aware that they have to make some sacrifices in order to win this.
Sure.
So at that time, President Roosevelt made it clear that he would have to take over to some extent the engine of industry in the United States in order to mobilize the war effort that was needed to fight the Nazi threat, the global Nazi threat. Now we're faced with a situation where we have an even more serious threat globally. This could destroy human civilization if we don't deal with it. And yet people are still trying to rely on the free market to solve the problem. And it's not working. And so instead of facing the fact that we have to reject those free market principles, and rely on some serious government intervention, people are denying the reality of climate change. This is a point that was made in Naomi Klein's new book, This Changes Everything. I think it's a very important point. What do you think about that?
I think it is an important point. And I think that it... free market ideology is so ingrained. Capitalism, neoliberalism, free markets. This is such powerful ideas in American society and American political discourse that I think it is probably a strategic mistake to say we need to have government, more government control and less market control, to make that kind of a centerpiece rhetorically of a platform. The climate mobilization, by using World War II as its central metaphor and as an example, all of the policies that we talk about as part of a climate mobilization are quite based on what this country actually did during World War II. So I think that by doing that, by really grabbing onto what is remembered so proudly by our country as perhaps its time of greatest achievement, that we managed to get across so much of what needs to happen in terms of government direct regulation and in transforming the economy into a renewable and even carbon negative economy, but without triggering so much of the gut reaction that, I mean, basically, that this is un-American, that we're saying absolutely not, this is solving climate change. We want to solve climate change like we fought World War II, and we want to be the leader once again. We want to be the most powerfully and successfully mobilized country. We want to lead the world towards a safe climate.
Well, I can certainly tell that you're going to be a great psychotherapist, because what I'm hearing is that you're not ignoring the real problem and how we're going to have to solve it, but you're figuring out a way that we can present this to, by analogy, the patient, to make them understand what they have to do to help themselves. Is that right?
Yeah. That's the idea.
Okay. Well, you know, I kind of was getting at earlier, there's actually several levels of denial involved in this. We talked initially about people who just deny the seriousness of it. And maybe those are the easiest people to get to. I don't know. But there are other classes of people as well. There are other people who accept the reality of climate change, but think that it's due to geoengineering. We know geoengineering is happening. It may be affecting the climate, but we don't know the degree of it. How do you ever run across these people that think geoengineering is causing all this problem? And how do you deal with them if you do?
Since I blog and publish articles on the internet, I come across people, and it's not just due to the internet, I come across people in real life, actually, also, who believe any number of things. People have their own theories about climate change, ranging from, natural cycles, the climate's always changing, something to do with, the sun is in a hotter phase right now, solar cycles, to the scientists are just making that up in order to get grant money. I mean, people will tell themselves whatever they, you know, I mean, any kind of explanation other than the true one, because the true one is the scariest. It's the problem is so huge, both on a climate level, like the impacts are so huge already, and the problem is so ingrained in that we use fossil fuels for everything in our economy. So when you take those things together, those facts about what's causing climate change, it makes people feel very small and helpless and overwhelmed. They just say, well, that the truth about climate change makes me feel so badly that I will believe anything else. And there's plenty of merchants of doubt out there ready to provide fictitious explanations for people that really relieve their fears.
So you would say that fear is really the motivator for this denial of climate change or the seriousness of climate change?
I think fear and helplessness. I think helplessness is really a key factor also.
For the people that acknowledge climate change but don't think they can do anything about it, sure.
Well, I'm always a little bit dubious I tend to think that everyone knows on some level, conscious or unconscious, that the climate is changing at this point. I mean, really, it's not just the scientific consensus, it's also noticeable. The weather and climate art have noticeably changed. So that's the idea of denial. It's not ignorance. It's not knowing something. It's knowing and then actively choosing, actively though unconsciously, choosing to reject and expel that knowledge.
Yeah, that's a good point. I guess more what we were talking about before was rationalization. There are some people that seem to actually deny reality of their senses. We have, was it Imhoff, the chair of the Environmental Committee, who actually, he threw a snowball out in the thing and said, see, this proves that global warming is not real. Totally denying all of the evidence. The extreme cold in the East is correlated with the extreme dryness and heat in the West. And how could he possibly not know that?
Yeah. I also find willful ignorance to be a very helpful concept. the best book that I read about denial is called States of Denial by Stanley Cohen. It's not specifically about climate change. It actually doesn't even mention climate change, which is unfortunate. But it was published in the late 90s, and it was about like genocides and the function of denial. I mean, how do genocides happen psychically, right? What goes on in the minds of the perpetrators, the victims, and the bystanders that allows this to happen? And yeah, willful ignorance is really key in both climate change and genocide, where you know enough that you know you don't want to know anymore. And yeah, you know that it's bad, and so you just try to stay as uninformed and ignorant as possible in order to try and protect yourself from this scary information.
Sure, and even people that accept the reality of climate change, again, they don't want to explore it deeply enough to think about what the consequences are going to be, or they would be either a lot more frightened and paralyzed or more motivated to help, depending on how they react to that.
Yeah.
So let me just, from there, again, if this thing is about fear, what are they afraid of? They're afraid of just thinking about the consequences to the environment, to their children, the economic consequences, maybe?
Well, the basic premise of the pledge to mobilize and the climate mobilization is that climate change threatens to cause the collapse of civilization. In the pledge to mobilize, we specify within this century.
Okay.
So to me, that is, I mean, yeah, that is the deepest fear. Maybe other people have other main fears, but yeah, I mean, just a uncontrollable and uncontained collapse. Lester Brown talks about droughts causing crop failure, causing failed states and resource wars and civil disruption, and causing entire regions to be destabilized. That was basically what happened in Syria when they suffered the most extreme drought in decades, if not centuries, and farmers had to relocate into urban centers and couldn't pay for food. And those are historically, it's very clear, those are revolutionary conditions. Mm-hmm. When people are hungry, they don't just passively take it. They get rowdy. They get they want to take back power. So you get the launch of groups like ISIS, and I mean, just it just becomes chaos in a situation of drought, famine, internal refugees, civil war. I mean, anything goes.
Okay.
And so that kind of collapse, that is to me, yeah, the real kind of nightmare. Though, I mean, it's really amazing. I mean, climate change is very literally the stuff of nightmares. I mean, we're talking about storms and fires and floods and disease and hunger and drought and violence. I mean, it's really quite a perfect storm of horrors. So yeah, I think people are afraid of it, though they I mean, in Florida, they're not even supposed to use the word. I mean, what would cause someone in administration to take such a rash and ridiculous action other than paralyzing fear?
Well, now, that's a government edict, and of course, politicians depend on contributions from some of the people who profit from the fossil fuel industry. I think that's probably the main motivation there. It's especially ironic that Florida politicians would take that position, because it's already quite clear that Miami will be underwater in the next 30 years. There's no way to stop it. It's literally physically impossible to stop it if the rate of sea level rise continues.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, absolutely. Regarding Florida, there's so much to say just about. But I think that fossil fuel companies, well, obviously, you know, have been spreading misinformation about climate change. You know, really been very bad actors in this, obviously. But I think they're in denial too. And that if they were to confront the truth of climate change, it would only be rational for them to get behind a mobilization. The idea that, like, fossil fuel companies, that there's going to be winners and losers in climate change, and fossil fuel companies will be winners, I think it's like rather a bizarre idea. They will also perish. I think that they're in a very difficult situation, and emotionally you can imagine maybe how guilt, their guilt would serve as a, as well as selfishness, but would serve as a barrier to accepting the truth of climate change, because it includes accepting, oh my God, we have been central in causing this. But it's not, they're committing suicide too.
Exactly. I've had the same thought. Although there is some promising evidence, not much yet, but some. I understand that, I can't remember which oil company it is, but it's a major. It's either Shell or Exxon, I think, that's talking now about diversifying into, or at least some of their executives are talking about diversifying into alternative energy. That's reassuring. Of course, the big question is, will they, and will they do it fast enough, and will somebody else just take up the slack? It's going to take government intervention in order to deal with this, and that's why the Climate Pledge, I'm sorry, is it called the Climate Pledge or the Climate Mobilization Pledge? That's why it's so important.
The Pledge to Mobilize.
Yeah, the Pledge to Mobilize. So you've mentioned it several times. Why don't you explain to people what the Pledge to Mobilize is?
Perfect. Thank you so much. The pledge is several things. Particularly, it is a public acknowledgement that climate change threatens the collapse of civilization. It is the primary moral issue of our time. It is a set of political demands that calls for a World War II scale climate mobilization, the U.S. to initiate a World War II scale climate mobilization that brings our national emissions to net zero carbon neutrality by 2025. So extremely ambitious platform. We also call for full employment during that mobilization and to make our top foreign policy priority to achieve global carbon neutrality at wartime speed and then continue removing carbon from the atmosphere because we're already past a safe level of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere until a safe climate is restored. So it's so that's the political platform. And then it's a set of political and personal commitments where the signer agrees to vote for political candidates on a local, state, and national level who have signed the pledge over those who have not, to only give time and money to candidates who have signed the pledge, and perhaps most importantly, to spread the truth of climate change and the pledge itself to others.
Wow.
So, yeah, so it's a whole little universe in there.
So there's a pledge for individuals that they can go to the website and sign that pledge, right?
Correct.
As well as a pledge for politicians. Now, I assume in you said people running for office. I assume that means incumbents?
Incumbents, yes, or challengers.
Okay.
Either one.
And so, do you have any incumbents that have taken the pledge yet?
Not yet for incumbents, no.
Okay.
We launched in September, and we have gotten, as far as candidates go, we've gotten about 600 signatures.
Uh-huh.
But we're speeding up, which is good. But and for candidates, we've gotten a fair amount of interest from candidates, but they are exclusively Green Party people planning to run in 2016.
Uh-huh. Yeah, they're easy pickings. I don't know if you're aware, but there's another pledge campaign that's been going on for a while. I actually started one, but it's been picked up by Move to Amend now, and that is one to amend the Constitution. We've seen that was actually pretty effective. Well, it wasn't the pledge, but it was pressure to get people to do something that led to a vote on the floor of the Senate to pass an amendment, which got a majority but not, it wasn't able to overcome a Republican filibuster. And unfortunately, it was along party lines. So the idea is to say this is not a partisan issue. This is not an ideological issue. This is an issue that affects everybody. Do we want democracy or not? And the corresponding argument here is, obviously, this is an issue that affects everybody, not just in America, but everybody on the planet. So it shouldn't matter what party they're from. But, of course, the easy pickings are people who've already taken that position, like the Green Party. I do just want to mention to our listeners that 623 does not sound like a big number, but the thing is, this is an exponential process. This is clearly what Margaret envisions. She expects that once the word gets out, one person can convince two people can convince four people. That's what we mean by an exponential process. So if you share this pledge with your friends, email, Facebook, Twitter, whatever, we can get more signatures. The more signatures they are, the more seriously people take it, the more likely they are to sign and share. So that's how these things work. That's how ideas go viral. Do not dismiss this because it's off. It's not off to a roaring start right off the bat. It takes time to organize. And the other thing, Margaret, I wanted to mention was when I checked out your website, you're looking for volunteers to help do that on a larger scale, right? Organizers in their areas.
So thank you for your most recent, what you just said. And to add to that, the Climate Mobilization as an organization is best considered as a startup, like a social movement startup. That's really, kind of the model for development that we've used. And we are, So we are new, but we're also changing very quickly. So what we're emphasizing now is really taking the pledge to mobilize public. So we have these action pages, the climatemobilization.org/action_pages, in which we break down step by step how you can go to a event, like a climate event or a related event, and share the pledge to mobilize there, have a discussion about the climate mobilization in your home, give a PowerPoint presentation about the climate mobilization in your home or in public, and or have a rally for the climate mobilization. We had our first ever rally for climate mobilization in San Diego about 10 days ago. 350 people came, and the march organizers, Nancy and Derek Cassidy, taped a copy of the pledge to mobilize onto the federal building.
Oh, wow.
which was quite thrilling. And an example of... those two are just quite a phenom, but they heard about the climate mobilization, they read our literature, and they said, yes, this is what we want, this is what we want to do. And they really planned and executed that march independently. And afterwards, the climate mobilization, is like, man, how did you do that? Tell us your secrets. But they did, and they're planning four more. But that is really, that is what we want to see as much as possible, is people who agree that we need a climate mobilization and that the pledge to mobilize as a strategy makes sense. We need to see them kind of take on the mantle of the idea and run with it, to create a climate mobilization for their city, and to hold events, this kind of thing. So that's what's very exciting about our growth I would say is that though it's relatively small numbers, there is a high level of commitment, not among everyone, but among enough people that, yeah, I think we can really, really go to the next level.
Well, and one of the things is you're not planning on becoming the movement. One of the elements of your strategy is to ally with other groups. Now, I actually listened to the conference you guys had discussing the San Diego action. And one of the things they mentioned was they reached out to 350.org and other organizations. How did that go? How did that reach out go? Any success getting coalition partners?
So, on a local level, absolutely. People from just about every climate organization have expressed interest and taken the pledge to mobilize. And something very cool about the San Diego March was actually that Marshall Saunders, the founder of Citizens Climate Lobby, spoke at the March for Mobilization.
Wow.
So we definitely, as you said, there's nothing mutually exclusive about signing the pledge to mobilize and being involved with any other climate group. There, it's the pledge to mobilize. The pledge to mobilize is a tool to fight denial and to turn concern about climate change and alarm about climate change into political power.
Absolutely. One of the things I want to mention, Margaret, is that when I was listening to that call, the organizers mentioned they had a little bit of trouble with one of the groups that wanted to know all about how you guys were organized and structured, and gave the impression they didn't really want to work with anybody that wasn't organized and structured in a way that they found pleasing and maybe even had the same goals and strategies. I've seen this problem many times when people are trying to build coalitions. Any thoughts about how you deal with that, or do you just accept it?
Yeah, it's a big question. And the pledge as a tool, I think, offers our best answer, which is we're flexible. We can be flexible about so many things, like tactics, approach tactics. But the pledge lays out what we believe is necessary to prevent the collapse of civilization. Mm-hmm. So the pledge kind of sets up what is non-negotiable, which is the demands. These are the demands that our organization is pursuing. And then what we can be flexible on and work with people on, which is everything else. But of course this causes disagreement, and the climate movement has a tendency to not want to name demands because the scale of what we need to accomplish is so daunting that it becomes difficult to talk about. Sure. But we think it's important to articulate what's necessary.
Well, let me just throw something out here. I think what you're talking about is you have a unique strategy that you hope other people will support, regardless of what else they're doing. You don't require them to buy into everything other than to support this. Maybe not even work on it, but show up to your rallies and
sure,
promote the idea, maybe share the idea on their website. But it does set a minimum level of expectations. Now, and not, I guess one of the things I got from what you were saying was you don't want to be too specific for that very reason. It starts splitting the movement. So you set minimum expectations. They're general enough where you don't get into arguments about exactly how you're going to accomplish it.
Yeah, nuclear or not nuclear.
Right.
No, that's not our, that's, we don't have a dog in that fight.
So that's how you get the biggest coalition that you can. The other question I had in regards to a coalition was, are you reaching out to, say, anti-war groups, since the military has the biggest footprint in the country and possibly in the world, the biggest carbon footprint? Are you reaching out to anti-war groups as an example of somebody who may not see their issue as connected?
Yeah, actually, I think we should do more of that.
Okay. Well, I was just actually talking to somebody who's trying to help organize a larger anti-war movement, which is something we sorely need. And he was saying, you know, that's what we have to do. If we can connect the dots between war and climate change in particular, but a lot of other issues too, like the economy, then we could build a much larger coalition. And we can support each other in our individual goals, because really it's all one problem. These things are all related. You talked earlier about the horrible devastation that will happen if we just allow global climate change to continue. We didn't really get into the economic costs. You talked about some of the human costs, but what about the economic costs? And again, I think that is part of what people are afraid of. They think if we convert from a current extractionist, fossil fuel-based, growth-based economy, that everything's going to fall apart and everybody will be poor. But there's a great counter-argument to that, isn't there?
Well, I think there is a couple, but I mean, we don't, at this point, have a choice. We cannot choose, should we make a change in our economy or should we keep our economy the same, right? That is, we can transform our economy through a planned and coordinated mobilization in which we all take part and are active participants in shaping the future, or we can experience a collapse of our economy and civilization that is unpredictable, unplannable, and we will become just passively trying to respond, trying to move to someplace more north, you know, find a farm, whatever. Yeah, that's the choice, whether we want to reshape our economy or just allow it to self-combust and kind of take us all down. So the idea of how much would it cost to solve climate change is, I mean, like a bizarre question, because the cost of not solving it is infinite. Naomi Klein said, I really liked her point, that one of the impacts of neoliberalism and the idea of humans as greedy, self-interested, economic actors is that we feel kind of like maybe it would be good if there were several billion less of us, and, you know, our economy is so destructive, maybe it would be good to just wipe it out. Also, I think it's made us feel very passive, like, and there's not anything we could do anyway. We're just in this, you know, market system. We're just consumers in this market system. And yeah, I don't agree with that. I think we should choose to survive. And changes that we need to make to the economy, we should make to the economy. And we should try to protect vulnerable people from disruption as much as possible during that transition. That's why the Pledge to Mobilize includes an employment guarantee full employment. But yeah, I mean, it's when people talk about the cost of transitioning off fossil fuels, it's denial.
Well, I certainly agree. But again, you mentioned early on in the show that one of the things you want to do is avoid bringing up ideas that sound so radical that they freak people out and they make them think, oh no, that's off the table already. So there is another argument, and this is actually what I was kind of getting at, although I totally agree with what you said. There is another argument that I don't think Naomi Klein actually explored in her book deeply enough. She did touch on it. And that is, if you look at the economics of getting off fossil fuels, there's a tremendous number of benefits. And the one I almost never hear mentioned is most of our wars are pretty much based on getting access to fossil fuels. So the cost of the military would be virtually eliminated if we did this. That's just one of the economic benefits of the conversion. Yeah. Can you name some other ones? Because I don't know them off the top of my head, but I know I've read about all kinds of economic benefits. So can you give us some other examples of economic benefits of this conversion?
Decentralization is a key one. That fossil fuel companies, especially oil, are owned by these giant corporations, whereas renewables are a much more distributed form of energy that distributes power, political power, economic power, as well as power in the form of electricity, much more broadly. I think that's a major benefit. I think that also, fossil fuels have so many downsides beyond their major apocalyptic climate effects. They also do things like contaminate groundwater, cause asthma and smog, explode when transported via train and in the Gulf and by tanker. I mean, they're so, we can do so much better. And we have no choice. We will transition off them, or we will collapse again.
Well, those are really good points. Let me just make a couple points about that. So you're saying there are other associated costs, both health costs, environmental costs, and transportation costs, and other economic costs of dependence on fossil fuels. So yeah. If we could eliminate shipping oil, for instance, if we could eliminate the wars that we have to have and the occupations to control these oil supplies, if we could end fracking and the environmental destruction, if we could end paying for the health care costs, it's not just that people's health is damaged, but that costs money, too, to do something about. So all of those things. And one of the points that you didn't quite make, but you were getting at, was if you don't have centralized energy production, electricity production in particular, then people can actually get free energy. Once they pay for solar rooftop panels or if they come up with an effective solar rooftop wind turbine, then they'll get their energy for free. I mean, there are already people doing this. And they pay it off pretty quickly. Actually, it used to take 20 years to pay off solar panels on a well-insulated house. Now it only takes about somewhere between 10 and 15. And the costs of installation have gone way down. That's part of the reason. So if you look at the cost of renewable energy, I read recently that it's cheaper.
That is totally in line with what I have read. And one of the most exciting things about the prospect of a mobilization to me is the amount of incredible technical innovation that we can expect from undertaking that. that, you know, World War II, we saw innovations in every field. I mean, major innovations in production, in medicine, in aeronautics, in physics, and, you know, the atomic bomb being the most notable and controversial. But in code breaking, in computers, I mean, in like mobilization is working towards a common purpose. And when we do that, yeah, the innovations are just amazing. The counterpoint to that is we can get to carbon neutral with existing technology. And that is important to remember, because yeah, people will say, oh, climate change, we'll just wait for, you know, the geniuses to solve that with some new piece of technology. And that is, yeah, we don't want to think like that, because that is passive and false. But yeah, so renewables are already so advanced and so affordable and so clean. But what would we have if we put a combination of our top minds from universities, from the government and the military, from Silicon Valley, if everybody was focused on this goal, what could we achieve? It's very exciting.
Well, absolutely. And I'm glad you made the point that we already have the technology. Some people want to deny that. And they also want to deny that, you know, it's realistic because it would be too expensive again. But the truth is, what they're not looking at is the fact that we are subsidizing the fossil fuel industry tremendously. I mean, just the cost of the wars alone that they absolutely depend on in order to monopolize the oil supplies. If we eliminated that and all the other associated costs, we could do it beginning tomorrow, and your goal is realistic. You said it was very ambitious to come to zero carbon footprint in 2025, but it all depends on how fast we can wake people up. And you are absolutely right, I think, to say that the only way we're going to do it is by putting political pressure on people, and that's through the pledge to mobilize. Now, I want to remind people, we're about out of time, but just a sec. Let me make sure I get this in. I want to remind people that you can go to theclimatemobilization.org. That's theclimatemobilization.org. You can sign the pledge, and if you do, if I'm not mistaken, Margaret, aren't you automatically put on your email list?
Yeah.
Okay. And that email list, I can tell you because I've done it, they do not send out daily or three times daily emails. It will not clog your email box, but they will let you know when something important is going on, like a phone conference, which you can participate in. And other things. When events are going on, you can also share when your events are. It's very easy to get a hold of Margaret through the website. So if you have any interest in helping, you can do that easily. Margaret, as I said, we're about out of time, but I want to say that I'm so pleased that you are doing this. I think we have to create a unified movement, and this is one great way to get the ball rolling in this area. All these things are connected, and they will converge, I know, in the end, once people realize, because the reality of climate change is all around us, once they realize that they have no choice, and that their children's future depends on it, you are going to succeed. That is to say, the movement will succeed through efforts like yours and all the other people who have already woken up. So Margaret Klein Salomon, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. That's it for Taking Back America for this week. Join us next week.